Good morning. Thank you so much for being here today from our agencies, from our cities, our local communities. Really appreciate your presence. We scheduled this time hoping it was one of the most available times in the last week of session that might work for everyone. We believe the other legislators will be joining us. We now have some meetings scheduled at 10, though, that several of us are supposed to be at. We might have gone a few minutes over, but it's an important ways and means meeting with some votes on some omnibus bills, so we should get over there fairly soon after 10. So we will have a very tight agenda. So as you note, I actually put minutes on the agenda so people had some idea of the kind of time frame we were dealing with on these various topics. Obviously, there's some flexibility, and we want to allow some time for questions from legislators as well. And the questions are included within those time frames, so keep it as brief as possible. Obviously, given both the level of number of topics, but also there are some new developments in some of these areas, I'm sure, in terms of research, but also the last topic on the agenda, I know there's some new information. Also, Ms. Thorvick's talk, there's some new information. So there's quite a lot of new information today. So obviously, we will use this as an initial briefing on any of these topics, and following that, an information gathering. We will determine to what extent we need to follow up soon after the end of session with some additional meetings with legislators on various subtopics here to get more information or to explore any kinds of actions or involvements we think are needed on our part. So we'll begin this morning with item number 3 on the agenda, which is from the Health Department. Ms. Yingling and Dr. Wooten. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm just going to give you a real brief update on what's been going on with the sampling work at the PFC investigation sites. You should have in your packet a map with some information on the back side of the map that will illustrate what I'm telling you about. Excuse me. As you know, we've been doing private and public well monitoring out in Washington County since 2004, and we continue to this day. To date, we've sampled over 1,100 private wells and 55 city wells. In addition to that, a number of what we call non-community public wells. So those are businesses, churches, schools, that sort of thing. And so some of the details of that sampling is shown on the back of this map. What the map illustrates is primarily the distribution of perfluorobutanoic acid, PFBA. So most of the color coding on the map shows those concentrations. The only exception is the red areas show where we have multiple PFCs, so PFOS and PFOA, the two that really trigger most of our drinking water advisories. Those are the areas shown in red. Excuse me. The main developments in terms of our sampling, we're really into routine monitoring at this point. We feel that we've defined the extent of the plumes, and so now we're monitoring to understand the behavior of the contamination. And what we're finding, as we've said before, is that the plumes appear to be extraordinarily stable, which has led us to also believe that what we're seeing is sort of the remnants of the plumes that pass through this area. So we don't expect to see much change in either shape, size, or concentration of the contaminated areas. The one exception that I've highlighted under the findings is the area nearest the Washington County landfill. The Pollution Control Agency will be talking about the remedial activities that they're undertaking at that site. As part of that, they had to shut off the groundwater extraction system, so they are not controlling the plumes while the remediation is occurring. And so in a few wells nearest that site, we have seen increasing concentrations of some of the PFCs. The Pollution Control Agency has undertaken much more frequent sampling of wells near the site to track any of that, and as needed, we'll be supplying filtration for any residents that exceed the drinking water standards. So far, we've only had one of those wells. Actually, it was kind of near the near our health risk limits, and then it went over, it just went up slightly, and so it was put onto a carbon filter. But that is being tracked by very frequent monitoring to make sure that we don't miss anything in terms of people's exposures. In terms of health advisories, we did issue 6 additional advisories last year and into this year. Several of those were triggered when the PFOA health risk limit was reduced from 0.5 to 0.3 parts per billion, so people who were kind of on the edge then were over simply because of that change in the health risk limit. And then a couple others who were sort of borderline, their concentrations went up slightly enough to put them over a additivity calculation, and so they were also issued well advisories and provided with bottled water and a filter if they wanted it.
Yes, Yingling, where were those located, the 6 new ones?
I believe 2 were up in Lake Elmo and 4 were down in the Cottage Grove area that's shown in red south of Highway 61 on your map.
And I apologize to those in the audience and to us on the panel, but you may have color copiers in your office. We don't in the state office building, except for very unique, specific cases. So we don't get to copy in color. So
you
might provide us the color copies for this. We don't have access to color copies.
All right. We'll make sure we do that in the future.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all I had to present, and I'd be glad to take any further questions.
Just to be clear on that last point, because you had mentioned that 6 advisories had been triggered when the limit changed.
Mm-hmm.
All 6 of these you mentioned, the 2 in Lake Elmo and the 4 in Cottage Grove, were because of the limit change?
No, and I don't know the number off the top of my head, but I believe there either 3 or 4 of them were triggered because of the change in the PFOA number. The others... The 2 up in Lake Elmo, one is near the landfill, one is further south. They were both sort of right on the edge, and they went up slightly, and so that put them over. The 4 down in Cottage Grove, I think 3, maybe 4 of them were changed because of the PFOA number.
Thank you, Ms. Yingling. I just wanted to ask, I thought you said that the concentrations are stable and not decreasing relatively, and I thought the expectation was that after a period of time the concentrations throughout the area would begin to decrease.
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, it's a matter of your time reference. Over time, certainly, but we're talking more in the terms of decades of how long it will take for concentrations to visibly decrease throughout this area as a result of remedial activities. I mean, the contamination's already out into the aquifer. What we're seeing is the slow release of the contamination from the aquifer into the water. And so, the PFCs are off in the fractures and the little back roads of the aquifer, basically, and they're slowly coming out over time. And so, what we've had for a long time is pump-out systems operating at all of these sites. The likelihood is that the concentrations before those pump-out systems were in place were much higher. We can't estimate what the concentrations were when this problem first evolved. We really do think what we're seeing is sort of the remnant of these plumes, a very stable remnant. And it's going to take a long time for the system to flush itself out. So simply cutting off the source, while that's obviously the first thing you want to do, it doesn't mean that the aquifer will then clean itself up in a really fast manner. And so almost all of the sites that we work on, especially with contaminants that don't naturally degrade, it's a very long time frame that we're talking about in terms of reduced concentrations.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I will try to keep this brief. I know we're in a really tight time frame. There are basically 3 topics that I plan to just touch on. One is an update to our health risk limit rules. A rules revision was announced on March 22nd, And this revision will include the health-based values for PFBA and PFBS. Those were health-based values that we developed in 2007 and then also last summer for PFBS, and so we are now proposing to take those through the rulemaking process and put those promulgate those values. We do have a public meeting scheduled for May 19th as our first public meeting, and if you'd like any more information, we have a lot of information on our website, and I can provide links to those. The second topic I'd like to just give you an update on is keeping abreast of research on the PFCs. We have a cooperative effort with actually the state of New Jersey to track literature that's coming out, and that's been extremely helpful to us. We also continue to contact EPA researchers, both who are conducting basic research on these chemicals, as well as with the Office of Water. You may recall that the Office of Water issued preliminary or provisional health assessment values, I believe in the fall of 2008, and their deadline for finalizing more permanent health assessment or health advisory values is the end of this year, so we're also keeping in contact with the staff scientists who are working on those values. There's also a scientific meeting coming up. It's called PFA Days. This is the third one that's being held. It's hosted by EPA in Research Triangle Park. It is June 8th to 10th this year. James Kelly from the Department of Health is an invited speaker, and Gene Johnson and myself will also be giving presentations at that meeting. And this is a meeting that we have found extremely useful in the past. Research scientists who are working on these chemicals come together to talk about the ongoing research, interpretation of that research and significance, etc. So we are planning to attend that meeting as well. The other is just to give you an update on any new research since the last work group meeting, which was in December. There have been some publications for the toxicity information. It's mainly focused on PFOA, has been the one that's most heavily studied. And the studies have focused on trying to determine how the chemicals cause the effects that they do in the body. There's not been any new effects identified, so these are effects that we were already aware of. And most of the studies are what's referred to as sort of mechanistic studies. So historically, what those studies, how they're conducted is they look at relatively high concentrations to try to identify how the chemical works. So to date, those studies have not impacted in terms of what our number is because they're actually conducted at levels higher than what our value is based on. But they are trying to figure out how the chemicals elicit the effects within the body. There's also been some research published on exposure sources, trying to figure out how the general public is exposed to these chemicals. So these are studies that are not conducted in on populations that are exposed to, let's say, contaminated water. This is the general population. So there have been modeling studies and also some additional environmental monitoring that's gone on. And what it suggests is for the general population that diet is likely the major source, and then for children that house dust, for example, also may be a contributing factor. The other thing that these studies have identified is there is an extremely high level of variability. So it's a difficult topic to address. There was one new paper that identified a new source for us anyway, and that was actually ski wax, for anybody who's interested. So there was a study in ski technicians that tracked them over the seasons and found that their levels did kind of go up during the skiing season versus others. So that was a new source that we hadn't really been aware of in the past. Another study that's been published, it was actually a partnership between the Minnesota Department of Health and the EPA, was a geographic distribution of PFCs in fish from Minnesota lakes and rivers. And that information from that study has been incorporated into the fish consumption advisory. And the normal fish advisory consumption press release is scheduled for May 10th, I believe. But that information was all incorporated into the fish advisories. The other topic for new research is epidemiology. And there's not a lot of new information to report since last December. But for those who are interested, there was a review article actually that just came out last Tuesday from the investigators for the large C8 study that's being conducted in the Ohio Valley. And that is public access article, so if anyone was interested, I can provide you with the link. It's a really long link, but I can provide that to you, so if you wanted to look at that. Their conclusions were largely that the epidemiology evidence remains very limited, and the data really is insufficient to draw firm conclusions at this point. But as I said, if anybody's interested, I can provide the link for that publication. And that is really all I had to sort of give you an update this morning. If you had any questions.
Thank you. First of all, in terms of the exposure source studies, you said there's high levels of variability, but you didn't say in which area the variability is occurring.
In terms of levels that are in the diet or the dust, so the exposure potential seems to be highly variable across, even within a particular category of a diet, et cetera. There just seems to be a lot of variability in terms of concentrations and potential for exposure to individuals.
In terms of epidemiology studies, could you list the areas of ongoing exploration, even though the data so far is insufficient to draw firm conclusions? What are the key areas that they're continuing to explore that are reviewed in the article?
Madam Chairman, they're looking at associations between the serum level and the types of health effects, and these are studies that I think we did mention at the last work group, associations with cholesterol or uric acid, thyroid function have been some of the main ones. Also, birth outcome and liver enzymes are the types of things that they were looking for to see if there was an association. So far, the only ones that are seen to be consistently associated are cholesterol and uric acid, but those associations are quite modest and are not always consistent.
Doctor, is there any effort on the part of the department to come up with a combined HRL for different PFCs? Remind me where that's at, because so now you're looking for PFBA and PFBS. You're undergoing rulemaking to come up with HRLs for those two chemicals? Is that what you said?
Madam Chairman, Senator Stephen, yes, we have numbers for those values, but they are not promulgated values, so we would like to actually promulgate them into rule. So there are values for individual chemicals. Combinations of chemicals are also dealt with by a requirement in our rule to look at additivity when you have a mixture of chemicals that affect the same target endpoint, which these chemicals do consistently have overlap usually with the liver as an endpoint. So they are looked at in combination when they do exist in combination, and that assessment is done. In terms of a single value that would combine all of them, we do not have plans to do that, partly because these chemicals, they have, on some things there's a pattern, and other things there's not a pattern in terms of how they behave. So at this point, we do not have plans to have a single value for, let's say, all PFCs, for example. So we do plan to look at the individual chemicals and develop values for them, and we have a recommendation in terms of when they occur in combination of how to address that as well.
So there is a recommendation of or guidelines for the department or the pollution control agency to follow because what if, for instance, you're below a household is just below a couple of different values, but their combined level would obviously be in excess of the recommended values. Does that trigger anything?
Madam Chairman, Senator Stephen, yes, we actually have promulgated a method in rule that requires you to look at them as a mixture. And I believe, I can ask Jenny, but I believe there are well advisories that were issued because it was triggered by the mixture of chemicals, not the individual ones. Yes.
Well, I want to take a moment just to welcome Representative Swales and also Representatives Abler and Torkelson and McNamara. Good morning. Thank you. We were on item three on the second speaker, Dr. Gooden, and we're just wrapping up that one. We're going quickly because we have Ways and Means now at 10, so we're trying to move through the schedule. Any further questions for Dr. Gooden? Thank you
right.
very much.
Thank you.
And we would like the link to that, if you could send that to us.
Yes, is there anyone in particular I should?
Send it to Kate Peruzzo.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll continue with Dr. Jean Johnson.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jean Johnson. I am with our Environmental Public Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program at the Department of Health, and I'll just give you a quick update of our activities since the last meeting. The first one you may have seen last week, we released a brief report that is a follow-up analysis of the PFC levels that were measured in our biomonitoring project. We just posted this on the web last week. This is actually something that we had planned when we designed the project. We selected communities, particularly the well community, because we knew that we would also have environmental data, and we had hoped to be able to link blood levels with the environmental well water levels. And so we were able to do that as a follow-up to our original project. So this is not any new data that we've collected. This is basically a linking of existing two different existing data sets.
And Dr. Johnson, just a moment. So in your packet, members, is this document that has MDH at the top, which is the results from this analysis?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. So I'll just call your attention to that document. This particular analysis did look just at the 98 people in the biomining project who had private wells. With levels of PFOA or PFOS above trace concentrations. And these are also homes for which we had existing well monitoring data. For each person in the project, the level of PFCs in their water was estimated by taking an average amount of PFOS and PFOA measured in the well samples from 2005 through 2008. So in some cases, we may have only had one sample. We may have had three or four, in which case we took an average. The analysis also took into account how old someone was, how long they lived in the community, and whether they were male or female. So we considered age, gender, and length of residence. Essentially, the well sampling data gives us our best estimate of what their past exposure might have been. We don't have sampling data prior to 2005. And the samples are all pre-filter, without filtration. On the back side of the handout, you can see two graphs there. Those are plots that show you that relationship between drinking water and blood levels. If there were a perfect correlation, what you would see there would be a straight line from the lower left, 0, 0, to the upper right. Of course, it's not a perfect correlation, but we do observe a pretty strong correlation there between drinking water and blood levels, which is what we would have expected. It shows that indeed the water does account, combined with age and gender, does account for about 40% of the variation that we see in people's blood levels. Again, this pertains to the 98 folks in the study. But it does also show that indeed there are other sources of exposure that contribute to that variation, as Ms. Yingling just mentioned, and Dr. Gayden also. Consumer products and diet are also significant contributors to individual exposures in the general population. So I think this just confirms that. It also does confirm that we would expect that with the removal of drinking PFCs from the drinking water, we would expect to see blood levels to continue to come down in this community. My second update, just to briefly on plans for a follow-up. You may remember the advisory panel did recommend that we conduct a follow-up to measure that change or that decline we expect to see in PFCs. We have continued to plan for that, working with our advisory panel. We have an advisory panel meeting coming up on June 8th. We'll be presenting a proposed protocol for that project, so we hope to be able to go ahead with that. We did ask the advisory panel, I know at our last meeting of this committee, questions were raised about whether we should be also looking at additional health outcomes or pursuing additional research studies. The advisory panel felt that at this time they did not recommend that the health department proceed with any additional research looking at health outcomes, so we won't be including that in this study. I don't think they ruled out the possibility that an academic institution or the university may want to do something, but at this time they didn't feel it was something that the health department should try to take on. They did note that there are several other large, well-designed studies that are ongoing. The C8 study in the Ohio River Valley, which has 60,000 people enrolled, I think they're very interested in looking at that one. There are also a couple of occupational studies still going on, major in occupational cohorts. So. Their feeling was that these studies would be probably more fruitful in terms of scientific findings. So, and that concludes my update.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Johnson, a couple things. Would you explain what the funding mechanism is going to be for the continued pilot program?
Well, that's, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We're hoping that we can do this with our existing state funds that we have for the tracking and biomonitoring program.
Okay. Then one more follow-up, Madam Chair. Has the Department of Health reached out to any of these academic institutions? This has been, when you talked about the more broad health impact or the correlation between some other health issues and maybe the chemical, at community meetings, at this prior meetings of this working group, there have been discussions about either the Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota, or some other academic institution, as you said in your testimony. But has the Department of Health actually reached out to pitch this idea to another academic institution?
Madam Chair, the University of Minnesota has two representatives on the advisory panel. So we have reached out to the university, both through the panel, but also I have talked with them personally and asked them what interest they would have in possibly doing some research on this, particularly Dr. Bruce Alexander. He is involved in the occupational research currently. So he basically did not express interest in pursuing the community studies. But beyond the University of Minnesota and those contacts, we have not reached out beyond that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Johnson, the group that we're studying with the biomonitoring, so I understand it, in the next biennium, there's no funding for this group for an ongoing, or how long did we fund it, if you can refresh the committee, and is it ongoing funding? Will these people be continue to monitor to see if we see any trends in the future? But I'm wondering about the next biennium specifically.
Madam Chair, I believe we are funded. We are in the second year, coming into the second year of the biennium, so we continue to have ongoing funding this next year. And I believe that funding, the entire funding for the state tracking and biomonitoring program is approximately $500,000, I believe, a year. There have been a couple of unallotments, however, so that the actual amount that we expect to receive next year will be closer in the ballpark of $400,000. We are fortunate that we now have an environmental public health tracking grant from the CDC, which has enabled us to do a lot of our tracking work now with the grant, so that does allow that some of these state funds are available for this project.
And if I can follow up, Madam Chair, and is the department going to come out with a recommendation? Is it your anticipation? I would hope that you would have a recommendation in the next biennium to continuing this monitoring. We don't want to have happen what happened up on the Iron Range with the mesothelioma possibility of having this good study ongoing and then stop. So I hope the agency knows that we should, whether it's a federal grant or the state funding, but we want to continue to monitor so we can watch the trends, and hopefully a lot of these people will want to still participate so we can get more information. It's my hope the agency is looking at that and we'll come back and make that a real priority. Thank you.
Ms. Wills. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Johnson, this may just be the fact that we've been talking about this issue now for 4 years. I can remember I was elected 4 years ago, and it seems like 1 week after I was sworn in, all of a sudden we had the PFC issue on the East Metro. So it's kind of been on my radar for a long time, but I've forgotten some of the details since we first started talking about it. I have a question about actual how you, when you're assessing the PFC levels in the people that you're studying, do you take into account household products, you know, things that they like, Teflon cookware, things like that, that they may have in the house that may also contribute to the levels that you're seeing? Just how do you, I mean, what is the overall scope of what you ask when the people become part of the study?
Yes, Madam Chair. With our initial biomonitoring project, we kept the scope very limited. We wanted to be sure we could do the task that we needed to get done with the resources we had. So we did not broaden the scope. We didn't do an extensive questionnaire to measure those kinds of other sources of exposure. We really, really stuck to the biomonitoring. We are currently developing, for the follow-up, we hope to be able to look a little more broadly. We are currently developing a more extensive questionnaire that we would like to be able to use that will look at some of these other sources. It will have, we're looking at some dietary questions, trying to get at some of the things that the research suggests might be contributing to exposure, but also some consumer product use, specifically use of stain-repellent compounds on carpets and furniture in the home. So we will be asking, broadening the scope a little bit to the extent that we can. Our sample size is very small, so that really limits what analysis we can do. But we want to at least be able to look at whether we can see anything that might suggest why some people are higher than others.
Okay, so, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Dr. Johnson. But in conclusion, I was going to say that the results are quite striking in that less than half of the differences are explained by potential water sources. And so it does raise these larger issues about the multiple sources of exposure. And going forward, or even now in the next week or so, if you have knowledge of this in terms of the C8 and Ohio studies, if there's research already emerging from those or any other place, nationally, internationally, about the potential pathways from these other exposures, I'd like to learn more about that in the committee. If you could forward us those links or those research citations, we appreciate it.
Okay.
So
I just have a follow-up to that.
To follow up on that, however, because as was stated earlier that the water concentration, the concentration of the chemicals in the water isn't going to go down over the next several decades, or it will take decades for it to go down, do you anticipate that the level, as these people who are primarily exposed to much higher levels of concentration than people outside of the East Metro, do you anticipate that because now they're on filtered water, that their concentrations will go down sooner than a couple decades from now?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do anticipate that. But you know, until obviously, if we measure it, we'll be able to know what that rate of decline is. That's what we're interested in finding out, just how quickly that's going to go down. But you know, based on what's being seen nationally within the general population, those declines are happening fairly rapidly over the course of 1, 2, or 3 years. There are measurable declines. That was also seen in a study in Germany, even after 1 year on filtered water, they were able to measure declines in PFCs in blood. So we think that we probably could measure a decline even now after 2 years.
So, Madam Chair, I just wanted to point that out, that it does make sense to filter the water to get the higher concentrations out, because you most likely will see a decline significantly in people's blood, and it's sometimes a bit of a side issue to talk about other pathways of exposure.
I certainly agree. That wasn't implying that we should stop filtering the water here at all.
No,
so thank you very much.
Thank
and we'll
you.
Move on to remediation update. Members, we are now on the blue overhead slide packet. Do keep in time our time frame and spend as little time on things we've seen before as possible, and just giving us kind of the update of anything that's new or developing.
It's not advancing. Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, I'm Doug Wedstein with the Superfund program at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'll provide a brief update on the three remediation sites that 3M is responsible for with respect to the settlement agreement and consent order. With respect to the Oakdale disposal site, 3M requested and received approval from us to operate the soil vapor extraction system longer. The reason for this was the residual VOC contamination in the soil was a concern to residents in that area, that when it would be excavated, there'd be some odors. Everyone agrees this is the proper thing to do. So that system is running. If you drive by on Highway 5, you'll see the piping and the equipment out there. The groundwater treatment facility was built and began operation earlier this year with additional wells. You can also see that on Highway 5 on the south side. The excavation of the soil is now planned to begin this fall. It'll be a rather quick excavation and should be out of there by the end of the year. That's the target, with backfilling of clean soil. This is just a photo of the treatment facility on the south side of Highway 5, just as it's being finished. This photo is an interior shot. I would just call your attention to the large vessel on the right, which is a carbon filtration vessel. That's essentially what the water runs through before it ends up in the sanitary sewer. 3M Woodbury, the main disposal excavation began in August and is complete. That area has been backfilled and seeded. Approximately 19,000 tons went to SKB, and about 4,000 tons went to a facility in Michigan. The northeast disposal area excavation will begin later this year. There's currently a soil vapor extraction system operating in that area right now. And that work will, again, all that excavation work will be finished by the end of the year. There is a request that was submitted to us by 3M to implement a phased reduction of the barrier well pumping system. We received that in March. It's currently under review by our staff and a third-party contractor. We've received correspondence from the cities asking that we meet with them prior to any decisions or approvals being made, and we did extend that date out to June 30th for any action. And then the groundwater treatment system for treatment of the Woodbury water, that design is ongoing. It's in concert with work down at Cottage Grove. And I'll talk about some more of that a little later, but the plan is to have that design work done most of this year, test work with construction implementation next year. This is just a refresher slide of the 3M Woodbury disposal site, approximately 700 acres. You can see the main disposal area, the northeast disposal area. The orange dots are the four barrier wells that are pumping out there. This is just a view of some of the excavation as it was just getting started at the Woodbury site. You can see soil stockpiled on liners where it's sampled, and then a determination is made as to where it needs to go. This is a more of a panoramic view as it's further along. Excavation depths are anywhere from 8 to 12 feet, depending upon what was found during the investigation. This is the area today. It's been backfilled with clean soil and reseeded. This slide shows that all the trucks that hauled material were lined and covered, whether they went to SKB or to Michigan. You can also see some backfilling of clean material in the background. They were fortunate they had very good weather this fall, and this work progressed quite rapidly. With respect to Cottage Grove, the excavation of the D1 and D2 disposal areas is complete. Approximately 21,500 tons were removed. That's about 860 truckloads. Those two areas have been D1's backfilled, D2 is currently being backfilled. Excavation will begin on the D9 disposal area later this month. The 3M is requesting a permit from the MPCA to conduct a pump test on the two groundwater extraction wells that were installed previously. This work is to get pumping rates, groundwater concentration information, basically information to help them design the system, the treatment system, taking into account water from Woodbury and the water needs of the facility. With respect to the East Cove, that sediment removal design work is ongoing, and excavation of the East Cove is planned to begin sometime next year as well. Just an overhead view, again, the areas of interest are sort of down that lower right side, the East Cove and the D1, D2, D9 areas. Just a shot, a photo of the D1 area being excavated. A lot of this work was done throughout the winter. This is just stockpiled material awaiting analysis to determine where it goes. It's on sand, which is then on a liner. This is the D1 area then backfilled with clean material. This is the D2 excavation in progress. The depths here were down to about 25 feet in various places. Again, another view of that as it was progressing. Stockpiled material awaiting analysis prior to shipment. And then this was just, I put this back here to show you the slide for SKB as it was being built, the liner system, leachate collection. And then this is the material that's being placed in there throughout the fall, winter, and rest of this year. So in summary, excavation work has begun at two of the three sites, but Oakdale will be initiated yet this year, and all excavation work should be finished by the end of this calendar year. Groundwater extraction systems have either been installed and they're operating or they're currently being designed. The East Cove sediment removal is in design now and will be work will begin next year. As the Department of Health mentioned, we do continue to monitor drinking water and respond to well advisories with the installation of granulated activated carbon filtration systems for those homes that receive well advisories and do the annual maintenance on those. And those costs are in turn passed on to 3M. And then Jeff Lewis is going to talk about Washington County.
Back in May of 2009, the Department of Administration awarded a grant to Enebeck Construction for an $18.7 million contract. The cleanup work that we're doing at Washington County was designed in consultation with URS Corporation. They're providing the on-site oversight work as the project is being completed. The total project, when we're probably done with it in a little over a year, is projected to cost us about $22 million. We're still well below our original estimate of $28.5 million. 3M Company, as part of our settlement agreement with them, is providing about $8 million towards that cleanup, and the remaining portions are coming from remediation fund and bonding dollars. The work includes picking up approximately 1.9 million cubic yards of mixed municipal waste, and that's out there, and industrial waste as well. Putting it on a liner system. The liner is a triple liner system that we're installing. We've done this type of work on a couple of other facilities so far, but this one is by far the largest one we've completed to date. As Ginny had mentioned, as part of our construction work that we're doing out there, we had to turn off the groundwater treatment system that we had in place. That treatment system was there mainly for the VOC contamination that was there. We did, as part of that work, also agreed to continue with a lot of the granulated activated carbon filter systems that were on residences immediately around the landfill. And we're We also stepped up our monitoring of groundwater sampling and residential well sampling work that we did to make sure we monitored any changes. Am I pushing the wrong one? Oh, I went two. Previous one that we skipped over. We did add three additional bedrock monitoring wells as part of our interest in both monitoring what happens when we turned off the pump out system, as well as our interest in monitoring how quickly the groundwater cleans up around that landfill. Those two additional, or three additional wells were placed, one immediately southeast of the landfill, one slightly to the west, and then one down southeast farther in some city park property. This slide shows kind of a schematic plan view of the work we're doing. The outline in pink is the existing footprint of the landfill. It was about 35 acres in size. We're moving it slightly to the south and shrinking it into the eight cells that are shown there, and we'll be reducing the footprint to about 25 acres in size. Thanks, David. This is an aerial view showing the construction. Cells A, D, and E were all completed last year, June through November. Cell B, down in that lower right-hand corner, the liner system is currently under construction. That will be completed probably this week. You can also see on this photo the soil borrow area that's down in the lower right-hand corner of the photo, where we're getting a lot of the sand material that we're using. And also, this photo shows up in that north end, there's a soil stockpile area that we took off of the previous cover off in the northwest corner. And that northeast corner is actually a temporary stockpile of solid waste that we excavated from that far south end to begin our work. If good weather continues, we're anticipating that the completion of all eight of those cells, including the cover system, will be accomplished this year. There will be a little bit of leftover work next year with some turf establishment, some other little minor things, but we're anticipating that this work will be done yet this construction season, which is a full year ahead of schedule.
Is it the enter key? Enter.
This photo shows the liner system. This is actually cell A that was being constructed last year. We start with a 2-foot compacted clay layer on the bottom. There's actually three layers of 60 mil plastic that's used for our main liner system. Between each layer, there's an independent drainage system that allows for monitoring of any potential seepage problems. Each of those eight cells have a drainage sump that's constructed, and all the cells are sloped towards those sump areas. Those sump areas that you can see in the photo there is where we collect any of the leachate that sits on top of the liner, and then that leachate will be recirculated back in.
Jeff, let me just interrupt you for the sake of time. Unless you're going to add some new things in terms of the description of this, is there anything new that we haven't heard in terms of any new developments? For example, we talked in the last meeting about the roundabout issue and transportation challenges. Has that been worked out? Is there anything else that's come up that we're not aware of?
No, I think the There isn't much else new. The roundabout issue, I think, has been taken care of. We're going, I think, MnDOT delayed a little bit the construction and then are going to be providing us for a way around that construction. So that problem has been taken care of.
Well, if we can leave it at that, unless you have, because of our time constraint, I know that my colleagues probably have some questions on this session. On this section, though, since we're going to devote a, try to save as much time to talk about the pump-out issue in its own section at the end here, if you could limit your questions to for the previous two speakers to non-pump-out issues.
Just
in McNamara.
Just real quick, Mr. Lewis, are you aware of any problems? There's been investigations with the contractor and the work ongoing of the workers at the actual installation of the liner. Has there been any findings by the Department of Labor that you're aware of any of the workers on site? There was a couple small, if I'm not mistaken, they had a diesel tank parked and it needed to be properly protected. But are you aware of any of the workers? There's been discussion in other committees here in the Minnesota House that the workers were in unsafe conditions. In my investigation, I have not found that. Are you aware of any?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, we did have an OSHA inspection out there last summer, and our contractor has actually asked for OSHA to come back again this year. When they were there last year, there were three extremely minor violations that they pointed out. One was no seat belt on the four-wheeler that they had on site. The second was a fire extinguisher was not located where they were doing some welding operations on the liner. And the third was fuel tank didn't have the proper safety precautions around it, but they were all extremely minor. There was no health issues that were brought up for any of the workers. And as far as we know, there were no penalties that were assessed from OSHA at all.
Thank you. Thank you.
On remediation other than pump out? No, we'll save our time then. Thank you. Thorvig, thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Thorvig, Municipal Division Director. And I'm talking about the solid waste regulatory approach that we're taking for PFCs.
We started just briefly, just to let members know, we have changed the order. So we are now on Ms. Thorvig, which is number 8 on our agenda.
Okay. We started looking at solid waste landfills where 3M wastewater treatment plant sludges were taken. We quickly realized that because of the residential and commercial uses of PFCs, that solid waste contains potentially considerable amounts of PFCs. So we started to broaden our investigation and look at other types of landfills as well. We took a phased approach, starting with the landfills that took 3M wastewater treatment plant sludges and then moving to other kinds of landfills. We were using a data-driven approach, and the purpose was to identify if PFCs impact landfill leachate, gas condensate, and landfill gas generated at solid waste landfills, and then secondly, to identify the potential exposure pathways that impact human health and the environment, namely the groundwater. We first evaluated landfills that took the 3M waste. Then we looked at 11 other types of landfills that did not take 3M waste: mixed municipal solid waste landfills, combustor ash landfills, and industrial landfills. We did find PFCs in leachate, so we looked at the 7 landfills that spray irrigate their leachate, and then we looked at 20 online demolition landfills. And we did find PFCs in all of our samples. It's in the gas, in the leachate, and we found it in the groundwater samples as well. As a result of our investigations, we analyzed the data, and we are moving into a regulatory approach, and that means that we are moving to place the burden on the permitted landfills for taking over the requirements related to the PFCs and the materials. In terms of the landfill gas, we'll revisit this issue once we have established risk exposure limits. So we're not doing anything more with that until we have more information on risk exposure. Much of the leachate generated at landfills are taken to wastewater treatment plants, and the way we are undergoing a wastewater treatment plant investigation, that's not done yet. So we have sampled all of the wastewater treatment plants that take landfill leachate, and we'll be coming out with recommendations on that a little later. In terms of the groundwater, what we're seeing is landfills are preventing impacts. So although leachate contains PFCs, we're not seeing contamination resulting from that leachate under liners. Most of the PFCs we're detecting are at low concentrations, which are comparable to ambient groundwater concentrations. The exception was two landfills that need further evaluation, and I'm going to talk about them quickly. The first is the Pine Bend landfill that's located in Dakota County. It took 3M wastewater treatment plant sludges in earlier years when the landfill was not lined, and so the release is coming from an unlined area of that landfill. The second landfill is the Summit Avenue demolition landfill. It's located in Blue Earth County. It did not take 3M sludges. It is an unlined landfill, and we'll be doing further investigation to try to identify the source of the PFC contamination. The other landfills that are having regulatory requirements put on them are the seven landfills that spray irrigate the leachate. So spray irrigation happens on areas away from a landfill, so agricultural land, so it's not under a liner system. And so we're beginning to require long-term management of the leachate, investigations on where it's going, what's happening in the soil, what's happening to the plants, and the degree of the management will be dependent on what we find from the investigation. At a minimum, there will be long-term sampling of leachate and gas condensate prior to the spray irrigation. We met with these landfills that have regulatory requirements coming on April 14th. We discussed the evaluation and the regulatory approach we're taking. We'll be developing permit modifications to implement regulatory requirements at the seven spray irrigation landfills and the two with the groundwater impacts, and we'll have those out this year. And that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Thorvick. And I'll start out with, in terms of this issue of now knowing that this exists in the gases and the leachate at these landfill sites, a whole variety of landfill sites, you talked about having rules to develop risk exposure limits. Do we have a basis in research nationally, internationally, or in our state to provide the basis of establishing such rules?
Madam Chair, I don't have the answer to the question, so you're going to be getting an update on the air monitoring, and perhaps those folks can respond to that question.
And on the issue of the leachate currently going to wastewater treatment plants, what is the capability of wastewater treatment plants to actually remove PFCs before releasing those waters? My impression in the past has been that it didn't, but update me and inform us as to where the status of that is.
Madam Chair, you're correct. The wastewater treatment plants, the treatment systems aren't designed to address PFCs. The concentration of PFCs being introduced by the leachate, though, in comparison with the total flow, is small. And we're not sure that there will be any significant impact at all on the receiving water, and that's part of what we're evaluating to see if that continues to be a good way to address landfill leachate.
Ms. Thorvig, and I'm not sure if you're right or Mr. Lewis, but if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Lewis said that they were going to recycle the pump-out water in that facility. And I guess my question, when you say recycle it, do you surface apply it? Then is the idea that the water content will evaporate and that the leachate with time will continue to run out? And doesn't it make more sense to keep that material inside the liner instead of taking it to wastewater treatment plants?
Madam Chair, Representative, a third way of managing leachate is landfill recirculation, what you're talking about, and we do have landfills that do recirculate. Not all landfills are set up to recirculate, and so they have to manage their leachate in different ways, but the landfill recirculation method is a good methodology because it keeps the leachate within the system.
A quick follow-up, but Ms. Thorvig, is it that sophisticated of an operation to change them over from trucking it out to surface applying it some way? Would that potentially need some state legislation or some grants or something to help them?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, it is a technical issue. Not all, you know, many of the landfills that currently are lined were designed many years ago. We haven't built any new landfills, especially mixed municipal solid waste landfills in the state for many years. So some are not really technically able to do it, but I don't know whether it's a money issue or not. And so we can get you more information on that.
And I believe the Washington County closed landfill is going to be recirculating the leachate after it's completed.
One of the slides that you have in our packet shows the circulation system being placed on top of cell A. If you do it during construction, it's not bad. If you do it afterwards, it's extremely expensive.
And so to that point, is it kind of policy going forward that the best approach is recirculation, and as we're doing new ones, as we are in this case, that is what's done for that reason, or is there other variables that affect that decision?
Madam Chair, we haven't had any really new landfills being proposed for a long time, so the state of the technology is, yes, that's the best way to handle the leachate, so going forward, that's what we would encourage. I think the other issue on our closed landfill program.
We're on construction sites, we're proposing that on any of the major ones.
Thank you very much.
If you don't have monoliner system, you don't have to.
Okay, good. We'll move real quickly to item number six, and if we could even do this in less than 5 minutes, that would be helpful. And then we'll be doing air monitoring right after that. These are topics we've been exposed to previously, and we do want to save a good amount of time for that. Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Hoff. The last presentation was a good reminder that something we discovered 3 years ago, that the PFC issue was not limited to the 3M disposal areas or operations, that indeed there were other sources, and that's a good example. We've been investigating that in a number of different ways, and I'll try to breeze through our results and focus it on just these two issue areas. But the reason we needed to look at this was try to understand that extent better, where we were finding it away from the 3M operational and disposal sites, to determine whether what we were finding was an issue of concern, and then to inform efforts such as the one you just heard describe for as we move into a more conventional regulatory approach. We have a number of studies underway. This partial list, I'll skip over that one for now, and we'll focus on the Mississippi River and air monitoring, and then Mr. Sandusky will follow me with that. Bottom line, we've completed an intensive study of the water and fish in the Mississippi River. It started about a year ago, and nearly 300 fish divided into four segments of the pool to try to get a good idea of really what the state of the fishery was there, both to inform the public for fish consumption, but also to help inform us as we moved into some next regulatory phases here and understanding the process of bioaccumulation from the concentrations of PFCs in the water to the fish, and setting limits to protect those fish and then the public that consumes them. This is a quick view of the Mississippi Pool 2, which runs from the Ford Dam to the Hastings Dam. And the sampling was taken in each of these four segments. We have a lot of data that we can share with you if you're interested on that. Conclusion, it confirmed that Pool 2 remains an impaired water based on a 1 meal a month fish consumption advisory determined by the health department for freshwater drum, and we've now moved on, and for PFOS, that's the only PFC, and we've moved on to beginning to develop the TMDL, and what that means is we have to look at other sources besides 3M's related sources, and that would include wastewater treatment plants that discharge to the pool, non-point sources, any other industrial sources, and the complex question of internal loading that might still be occurring from sediment that from the receiving waters over the years. So that's the last slide on Mississippi.
On that, you confirmed that's still a problem. Has it increased, decreased, remained the same?
The fish tissue study shows that approximately that it's staying the same. We have a larger data set, but so far in the years we've monitored, we don't have enough to show a downward trend that we all are hoping for over time, as with groundwater. Moving to air monitoring, this has been an issue of interest. Obviously, it's been important to focus on the exposure pathways of drinking water and fish consumption that we've had over time, but this question had been in the background of our minds. I know a number of your members here were interested in it. We were interested in it. Public was. There are many technical challenges associated with air monitoring. It has not been done very much anywhere in the world, and so we were pioneering methods in a sense here for use in our regulatory purposes. One of the other challenges is there are no air quality standards for PFCs. But despite that, it was important to move on and try. You have to start somewhere, and these are important questions that people have in their mind, and we just decided to go ahead, see what we could find out, and learn from it and adapt. This is a map of our monitoring network. We started out by monitoring at Cedar Creek in northern Anoka County, a remote area far away from any known influence of PFCs, and sure enough, we were able to detect them at very, very low levels. We moved in a little closer to both Blaine and then Red Rock Road, which is at the intersection of 494 and 61 approximately. Got some more background information there. And as the remediation sites began to come closer to the commencement of excavation and digging and stirring the soil, we were in a good position then from what we had learned to be able to monitor both before and during the excavation at each of these remediation sites. This map does not yet include the Oakdale site, but it will when that gets closer. So here's a brief summary. I mentioned our background on the left of the times and durations. You can take a look at that in your package. The picture in the upper right is the monitor itself. It's a canister with two types of filters that can weigh both the solid particle fraction and the gaseous phase, so that we're able to capture PFCs that come in both of those. What that does, though, is since as you look at this, it's a type of filter that has to be removed, taken away, shipped to a lab. It doesn't give us an instantaneous reading like we're able to do with some conventional air pollutants. And what that means then is it takes a long time to find out what we've actually been monitoring, and not really any real time to react to it on site. And so that's just the limits of the technology in front of us right now. So here's the first set of results that we had, and we'll start with the Washington County landfill, and I want you to take a look at the left-hand side of the diagram, the y-axis first, to put this in the proper perspective. This represents 21 different samples at the Washington County landfill site, 3 before and 18 after. On the left-hand side is the scale. We're talking about nanograms per cubic meter of air, and they are, it's a very small number. That's roughly equivalent to parts per trillion. It's not a perfect comparison, but that's approximately what that equals. And air samples don't work quite the same as water. And so what we're looking at here are very, very small numbers. The top bar on the chart is 1.5 parts per trillion. And the diagram, the one reading on the right, this presents the different range of statistics of readings that we got during the sample, and the arrow on the right represents a single one high value. The important number below that, and near the bottom of the diagram, is the top of the blue bar if you're looking at, or the dark gray bar if you're not looking at a color sheet. And that's the mean, the average of exposure, and that's quite low. Even in that one on the far right, the mean is barely above it's below, less than a tenth of a part per trillion. So And we'll try to put this in perspective for you just in a minute with Dr. Gayden from the Health Department as to what this means. I'm going to quickly jump to Woodbury. Very, very little detection there, very, very low numbers. I mean, everything was detectable, but in very, very low concentrations. Woodbury site, quick dig, and we did take two samples after the dig was concluded at Woodbury, because we were only able to get one ahead of time, and I wanted to get a little better idea of what the background is. And in each of these, I should note that we're comparing it to the column that says Metro on these diagrams represents the Blaine air monitoring station that is our reference site far away from the dig, so we can compare to what's going on at a dig to what's in the general background of the air. This is the Cottage Grove site. Again, looking at the scale on the left, we're here at a 1.5 parts per trillion in the top, and we did get some slightly higher values there that are still less than 5 parts per trillion, even though they point an arrow off the diagram. The means are a little higher. This is located very close to the dig itself on the Cottage Grove property. And so we're left with the questions here. What does this mean? Are these levels that we should be concerned about? Just because they're very small numbers doesn't mean they're not important. We've learned that in the past and many other issues. So for that reason, we asked the Health Department's risk assessment experts to help us evaluate the meaning. And I'd like to ask Helen Gayden to come back to the table and give her interpretation of those results.
Madam Chair, committee members, what we did, since as was indicated, there are no existing inhalation guidance values, we did a conservative screening assessment on the data that Paul just provided. What we did was, using conservative assumptions, we assumed that an individual, we looked at the maximum values that were detected in air and assumed that an individual would be continuously exposed to those high levels. Although, as he indicated too, that these were peak values, so they were not a continuous exposure. But that is what we assumed. We also assumed that whatever someone inhaled, they would absorb it into their body, which is another conservative assumption. And they would do this continuously for years. Based on those assumptions, we were able to estimate a theoretical dose of what that individual would take into their body. That value was then compared to our existing reference doses for these chemicals. And again, just a reminder that reference dose actually represents a dose at which you would not anticipate seeing health effects. Based on those assumptions and that comparison, these air concentrations were only a very small fraction of the reference dose. So we do not feel that there is a health issue posed by these air concentrations. Are there any questions on that?
Just real quick, Dr. Gayden, and you must have the information, 3M has done a study of their employees. Are you able to utilize some of that information to help you? Because my guess is that air exposure must be at the plant or was at the plant back then. Is that of some value to help you in determining what effect that may have? Because some of those may have only been exposed to the air part of it, not to the actual chemical, the handling. They were in different departments or whatever.
Madam Chair, Ms. McNamara, the studies were not directly used from occupational. I don't believe it's known whether the exposures to the workers was inhalation dermal or dermal, basically. And so the reference values that we've used were based on animal studies, and they incorporate inputs into those values. So the worker studies were not directly used in informing this comparison.
Madam Chair, we note that we will continue to monitor during the excavation. Hopefully we'll find the same sorts of results and conclusions so far, but we really won't know until you break into the waste, and we'll keep you informed on what we find. And as a reminder, these kinds of emissions are temporary, and they are a necessary side effect of doing what has to be done in digging the wastes up and securing the sites to protect soil and groundwater. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mike Sandusky, who will give a brief update on a couple other related matters.
Mike, yes, if we could keep this maybe 2 minutes or so, then we'll move on to our
Mike Sandusky, Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division. I'm going to tell you about something you already know, something you don't know, and a few concluding remarks. Number one, Lake Calhoun. If you've been reading the papers, you know that the agency, with the good help of the Minneapolis Park Board and the City of St. Louis Park, has completed part of our investigation on the sources of contamination of PFOS in Lake Calhoun. We have, in fact, identified one source. This isn't to mean that it is the source, because we've already had discussion here about the various contributions and types to our PFC contamination problem in the state, and we're working with that company to eliminate those sources. My quick segue, the reason I bring that up, is that we are now working with the following folks on a pilot program to attack that specific issue. I'm talking about, and this is a current term, it may change, the Sustainable Technology Partnership for Surface Finishing Project with the following members. The PCA, of course, Region 5 of US EPA, the National Association for Surface Finishing, and the Minnesota Association of Metal Finishers. And I'm going to read something that's a quote. This is a pilot project we're all enjoined in to, and I quote, reduce and where feasible eliminate the Minnesota finishing industry's use of long chain PFCs in fume suppressants. You'll recall that, if you've been following this closely, which I'm sure you all have, that Brainerd a couple of years ago was another source where, in fact, plating is involved in a contamination of PFOS. So just to let you know, there's quite an assortment of energy being used to direct our efforts at eliminating these sources to water. And finally, this is just a little bit conceptual. With Ms. Thorvig's presentation, with this information, with references to the agency beginning the TMDL for Pool 2, I want to make it clear that these are success stories for us, because since the beginning of this issue, with the help of the money from the 3M consent decree, we've been doing ambient monitoring work to understand presence and concentration, and trying to evolve that to regulatory approaches, which is our, of course, core business. And Ms. Thorvig's reference to actually getting to the point where we have an approach, a regulatory approach for landfills, for example, is one of the successes that we're trying to reach on several fronts. With that, I'll stand for any questions and get the heck out of here.
I'm going to take this answer offline. You can send us an email, provide something later. But if you could clarify for me the history of the production of the chemicals and materials that are used in these finishing processes, is this historical, or it's or PFC-based products are still ongoing produced? Who's producing them? How has the industry supplied them? Was there any plan for discontinuation of them already in place, et cetera? So if you give me a little briefing, one-page memo for all of us on that topic.
I'd be glad to
because,
do that.
Because, you know, we've been talking about, we thought these chemicals were no longer being produced, many of them. I know some variations have been, but if you could clarify that, who's producing what, when, and for whom, and what are the status of discussions for phasing out, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Will do.
Okay. To the last topic on the agenda then, and again, my plan, although my colleagues can do as they need to, is to, we have about 10 minutes formally before some of us have other committee meetings. My plan is to run this over about 15 minutes. I know four of us, including Nora Slavik, are on Ways and Means. Can you all, is that okay with you to go 15 minutes, or do you want to leave right at 10 o'clock? Since we have people in the room, we will have to continue with this discussion at another date as well, though. So on this topic, if we could have the appropriate person from PCA and Department of Natural Resources come sit up front, and if you could give us a brief presentation in terms of background, in terms of where all pumping out is going on, the nature of the 3M requests for reducing the pumping out, how the continued water that's going to be pumped out from the Woodbury and Cottage Grove sources, which currently has not been treated, it's been released without treatment of PFCs, is planned to be treated, and at what concentrations and where will that water be released. Those are the kinds of topics we're interested in, clarifying that. Obviously, a letter has gone out from Cottage Grove and Woodbury in late March to the agencies raising concerns about the pumping issues and the final disposition of the water. The agency, at least the PCA, has responded, at least. I've seen that letter saying that it's under the statute currently, my understanding was, do not dictate how the water is ultimately disposed of, only is involved in determining the appropriate pumping to deal with the pollution remediation issues. So we just want to, today, probably mostly get information on the table so you can come to some common understandings of this. And go ahead and please introduce yourself again.
Jim Japs, Assistant Director, DNR Division of Waters. Do you want me to start out, or do you want to give the overview, or?
Either way.
Why don't I just outline what the department's role is in this? Mm-hmm. Health Department and PCA are involved with the health issues and the water quality. The DNR is responsible for water quantity issues. So we issue a water appropriation permit for any sort of pumping that exceeds 10,000 gallons a day, a million gallons per year. 3M does have a couple permits with us currently for the Woodbury and Cottage Grove sites. We look at three things when we issue water appropriation permits, and that's the impact to other users, the impact on natural resources and the aquifer itself, and then the efficiency of use. And Minnesota statutes actually encourage the reuse of water, and we certainly do also. I know that 3M currently has some reuse that they do with these wells now. We have not received an application for the two new wells that PCA mentioned were going to be test pumped for, I think it was 12 months to 18 months. We will require a permit or a permit amendment for that, and we'll be working with 3M and others to look at beneficial reuse for that water.
Before you proceed, I just want to say, make a few more comments on the scope of this issue. I think in terms of not only local officials, but even citizens now. This last week, I think unrelated to conversations we've been having with Woodbury and Cottage Grove, I received calls from Lake Elmo residents on Lake Elmo, commenting on the extent to which the lake levels have fallen in Lake Elmo. And have asked me to help gather more comprehensive information about how much that fall has been, first of all, because there's some disagreements with the DNR and the watershed folks as to how much of a drop-off there's actually been. But more importantly, they've raised questions even about, is this just general drought and our lake levels are declining like everybody else's? And I don't expect this to be answered today, but I will be seeking this information next few weeks. Or is this related somehow, at least a portion of it, to the various pumping outs going on? And not only do we have this ongoing pumping out that's occurred for years south in Woodbury, there used to be pumping out, you know, north at the Washington County landfill, and now we have pumping out going on at the Superfund site, at the Hector's Market site as well. So it just raised questions in residents' minds about whether lake level declines, as you said, affecting the natural resources, is partly being affected by this water pump out issue. I just lay on the table, I don't want you to answer that right now. Okay. I mean, if you have, because my guess is there's not a quick and easy answer, so let's take the core issues we've raised today, but that is an issue we'll want to address this week and going on further. And if we have time today, you can. But I want to continue with this general conversation, mostly focused on Woodbury and Cottage Grove now, because that's what came to us first. Now PCA, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, I'm Doug Wettstein with the MPCA. Maybe as just a bit of background, just so everybody kind of has an idea of the scope of things. As was stated, DNR permits these large wells as far as the total volumes. The current combined pumping rate is close to 7 million gallons per day, and that's between Cottage Grove and Woodbury. And the uses are for non-contact cooling water and process production water. When you split it, it is sort of divided up for Cottage Grove. It's about
to
2.5 million gallons per day, and Woodbury is about 4.4. So that's where that split is. So you can see there's more water coming out of Woodbury than Cottage Grove. And then the barrier wells at Woodbury have been pumping virtually that same amount for quite some time. When the settlement agreement consent order was executed, it required 3M to look at pumping additional water at the Cottage Grove facility to intercept contaminated groundwater before it enters the Mississippi River from the disposal areas. So all along, 3M knew that additional water was going to have to be pumped. It was just a question of how much. But when looking at the big picture, for the four wells at Woodbury, two of them do the heavy lifting. And so what they have come to us with is a request to evaluate whether or not some of those wells can be taken out of service because they're not really pumping as much water, and in doing this in a phased approach. So the request that we have before us really is, part one is to take two of the four wells out of service, the two lowest pumping wells, and that represents about 25% volume reduction. They will evaluate that for 6 months, taking all kinds of field measurements, generating a report that will come back to us, and only with our permission would they then be allowed to go into the phase two approach, and that is to actually step down the two existing pumping wells. No one knows where this will end up, but there needs to be verification of capture, and there's something like 42 monitoring wells out there that can be tested. So what we're looking at before we approve anything, at least for phase one, is number one, we asked our consultant to reaffirm that there's capture right now. Four other firms have said there's capture. We want a fifth opinion that what's going on right now is doing the job before we even begin, and that the phased approach, as proposed by 3M, is an appropriate method. And then thirdly, what if anything additional is required to maintain or verify that capture is being maintained? And that is sort of what's before us. That's for Woodbury. At Cottage Grove, the RI indicated that perhaps five additional wells may need to go in. And that's all based on early numbers and estimates and things. That's probably the worst case scenario that was picked up by the Pioneer Press, and where that 9.2 million gallons per day figure came from. It is five additional wells. Two have been drilled. In all likelihood, an additional well or two may go in, but the reason for doing the pump test on the two that have been installed is to get the information on capture for those two wells, figure out what those pumping rates would need to be, because they do not want to be pulling in, they need to pump enough water for capture, but if they pull in too much, they're pulling in river water. And ultimately, they do not want to have to treat any more water than they need to. So they're going to run, they've requested permission to run about a 12 to 18 month pump test on those two wells. That will determine if a third or fourth well is necessary. It'll give them water characteristic information, because there's other things in that water besides PFCs that they need to take into account when designing the treatment system. They'll also get concentrations of PFCs, and all this information, along with the volumes being pumped and the needs of the facility, will go into this water balance management that will determine what the pumping rates are going to need to be for capture, what the treatment facility design needs to look like, and still provide the 7 million gallons a day that they need to operate. And I think that's pretty much the nutshell. So we have two requests before us. Now, the rest of your questions.
Before you go to the sure. questions, let me one clarifying question. The technical definition of capture, I have kind of a gut sense of it, but would you define capture for us in this context so we'll make sure we're all clear?
Capture would mean that no additional contaminated groundwater is getting off the site. Or, in the case of Cottage Grove, would be getting from the property into the river.
I'll just ask one more clarifying question, then we'll go to the others. The other issue in terms of clarifying for us, how much of the original pumping before the consent agreement was based on environmental needs for capture at the Woodbury site or elsewhere versus the plant needs for water for use? That's another concern I have.
I don't know if I can answer that completely. I do know, though, that pumps went in at Woodbury and at Cottage Grove to capture contaminated groundwater, and that the facility uses that water for one reason or another. Currently, some of it's treated before it's discharged. In the case of Woodbury water, it was not, but the consent order requires that all the water be treated prior to discharge. 3M would have to answer the question on how they used all that water.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you know this, but prior to being up here for the last 4 years, I was on the City Council, and during that time, we had did a big master comprehensive plan for development. And I know that when this came up 4 years ago, one of my biggest concerns was the placement of these wells for the city of Cottage Grove and how much it would affect the development plans that are expensive and the planning purposes for the city. I'm wondering, is 3M and the department in contact with the city planner who happens to actually, and the developer, who actually, city developer who actually happens to be here today, are you in contact with them so that you're on the same page about a location, about some of these other issues that you're discussing for the city?
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, yes, we are. Myself and a number of other people were at the Environmental Commission meeting about a month ago, and I presented and talked about some of these pumping questions that were coming up. We may not have actually received the requests by them, but we certainly knew what the consent order was requiring. We also copy them on submittals that we receive. We also put this information on our website. The two requests that we have are public. We've received the correspondence from them and have contacted them via email that, yep, we're willing to meet. We won't make any decisions until we've all had a chance to talk about this. And that we extended our time frame for which we were going to make the decisions.
Okay. Just one follow-up more comment is that I just don't want to hear, because I'm done, so I don't want to hear that these folks in the year from now are dealing with the fact of a very caught off guard or a very long, extensive discussion about the lack of conversation or transparency with the city of Cottage Grove regarding the location of these new wells, because that takes a long time to go through that process when you have the commissions, and Cottage Grove does a wonderful, wonderful job of transparency and public testimony on their developments and everything like that. It took a long time in a lot of discussion, so it's not something that can just be turned around in a month or two. So if there needs to be adjustment to comprehensive plans and all the other plans that have to go through with the city, it's not something that can be turned around in a short period of time. So I just kind of want to put that on the record for that.
Duly noted.
One of the specific questions I had was in terms of the post cleaning of the contaminants from the water, now that's going to be going through eventually after this pilot phase process. What are the standards for contamination levels in that water, and what is the basis for the standards being released into the river or elsewhere if it ultimately might be used elsewhere?
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, that's the one question that is still being evaluated. Those ultimate discharge numbers, which are permit specific to the facility, have not yet been determined.
And would you outline for us the regulatory process overseeing the determination of that and the state and federal interactions around that?
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, that would be through the NPDES permitting process. And there are other folks at the MPCA that are better able to speak to that than I. And so I really wouldn't want to go too much further into that. That part of this issue is sort of handed off to them when it's time for them to sort of run with it. And we're there. They're working on it. We require coordination with the pump test requests for Cottage Grove because it all plays into it as well.
Okay.
In other words, the pump test water has to be treated before, you know, it can't just be pumped up and released.
And before I go to centers, even just to be clear on that point, so it's MPTS standards, which are federally informed standards. I don't know if our state ones are more stringent or not, but it's federal standards on that regarding release into the river. So it's the allowed levels from that point source under federal standards for pollutants into the river. Do we have established MPTS standards for PFCs at the federal level?
Madam Chair, I don't believe there are any established standards, but the Clean Water Act does come into play here. I remember earlier on I mentioned that we've begun work on the TMDL. And one of the other things that the intensive Pool 2 study, the Fish and Water study, did was to give us more data to establish what we call a site-specific water quality criterion for PFOS. And that has been established for Mississippi Pool 2, and it represents the level that we must eventually meet in the river, and that will be a very low level of 7, it's going to be set at 7 parts per trillion. And what that does is, that's the starting point then for going back into all the sources that we can find and know about that contribute discharges to Pool 2, including 3M, their wastewater treatment plant, and any discharge associated with the pump out. It would also apply to other sources upstream. So in the process of when these permits come in for renewal, revision, reissuance, this is a new factor now that comes into play if there's a source of PFOS that's associated with those permits. That's about what we know at this time.
Madam Chair, I was just going to follow up. I think you answered my question, but just to be clear, so right now there's no requirement that the pumped out water needs to be treated to drinking water standards?
I don't believe so. I'm not sure if Helen, do you know that what the drinking water standard would be, or could tell me what that is? The goal for the river will be 7 parts per trillion, and I believe the drinking water standard is quite a bit higher than that. Is that correct?
The drinking water numbers is quite a bit higher than the surface water value, and I do not believe that section of the river is classified as drinking water, so it would not apply to that area.
We raise that for a number of reasons, I think, but one of them, which is that if cities have concerns about whether release into the river is the only, they may have an interest in looking at other possible uses of this water back into the system elsewhere, as not just the river, and therefore the issue of what standard and what concentration is in play in terms of that discussion, that they would want to look further at that issue. So we
Mr. Wetstein, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify. So 3M currently wants to reduce or wants to turn off or stop pumping at 2 of the wells. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, that's correct. The request that we have in front of us is it's a phased request. The first part is to stop pumping 2 of 4 wells, the lowest 2 producers.
And in your opinion, or the PCA's view, what's the benefit to the public to stop that pump out? Is because you don't use that water then, but then the water also isn't being treated.
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, the issue is that those 4 wells may be over pumping, pulling in more water than they really need to. And so by stepping it down, they may be able to reduce the volume of water pumped at Woodbury and still maintain capture. This would be in response to the comments that we received during the public comment period for this site, where folks did express concern over the volumes of water that were being pumped. I might also take this opportunity to just remind folks, because it did come up earlier, that the new wells that we're talking about at Cottage Grove are relatively shallow. and they're in very close proximity to the river on 3M property. They'd be very far in terms of a geographic distance from any area that I believe the city would be interested in for municipal wells. Just to remind folks that the two that are installed are right down along the river, and any other wells that would need to go in would be along that property line as well.
If I can have a follow-up to Senator Seaman. So is, we want to look at the possibility. Do you actually have, you mentioned a little bit, you can tell if the water that you're pumping out is, the source is more river water than groundwater? Is there a way you can tell that? Because I would think we wouldn't want to do that. We want the groundwater. So you're saying by actually taking it too fast, we would just be taking the river water? And is it by the makeup of the water you can tell?
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, that's correct. If you would pump too hard that close to the river, you would start to pull river water into these wells. 3M does not want to do that. All they want to do is intercept what's getting to the river and really nothing more. There would be water chemistry specific to the river. I don't know exactly how they could differentiate, but I believe it's possible through chemical analysis to know what they're pumping and from where it's coming, as well as any modeling based on measurements and things that would be done concurrent with all of this testing and pumping.
Just one last question. Mr. Wetzing, could you clarify in the letter that you sent back to the cities regarding the pump-out water, the MPCA says that under state Superfund statutes, the MPCA cannot require 3M to utilize remedial pump-out water for beneficial reuse. That's in, I think it's in contrast to what Mr. Japs just told us from the DNR. So what is where, I believe Mr. Japs said that the DNR could regulate, or under its permit, could look for a beneficial reuse of the water. So who is the city supposed to listen to, the DNR or the PCA?
Madam Chair, members of the Oversight Committee, as we stated in the letter, the Superfund process requires that the water be intercepted, cleaned up. It does not specify what happens to it at that point. Now, that said, both the state and federal governments do not stand in the way of beneficial reuse. It's being done many different places, even in the metro area, but it is not mandated. It's not a requirement of state or federal Superfund law.
That sounds like, Mr. Japs, it's in contrast to what you said, which I should have written down exactly, but something about how our state statute says that the DNR needs to encourage the beneficial use of water.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do encourage the reuse of water. It's not always feasible. You need to look at, you know, what reuse options are available, the quality of the water, and any other sort of public health and welfare concerns. So while it's a goal, it's something that we can't always require. We do look at it as part of the process, though.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Japs, in terms of the word encourage, is there any incentive system in place for them to do so, or any penalties if they don't do so? Is there any strength behind the word encourage?
There's as an application requirement under 103G301, one of the requirements is alternatives to the proposed action in the permit application, including conservation measures to improve water use efficiencies and reduce water demands. So it's actually an application requirement that they look at these alternatives.
We're going to need to let members leave now for our meeting. I want to say a couple things in conclusion. I think we have learned a number of new things from the research efforts that have been been underway at PCA and MDH today that we'll want to follow up in terms of this last issue and also the Lake Elmo issue. I'm going to stay after to speak to you about the Lake Elmo issue briefly, but in terms of the last issue, I know that other legislators and myself want to continue to meet with the cities in conjunction with AGES, but also we'd like to meet with 3M either with that group or separately to hear clarification for you, see if we have the story straight from your point of view in terms of your goals, in terms of these requests and how you see the pilot projects and others measure proceeding. We would like to have had time to do that today as well, but there just wasn't time. But we will look forward to doing that as legislators as well. So thank you all very much for coming this morning, and I appreciate your consideration for the tightness of our schedule at this point in session. Thank you very much. Thank you.